who is the representative for this child? Who speaks for this child?
Welcome, and this is Far Betterment. Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining me on another episode of Far Betterment, the podcast where we learn new things about old friends and old things about new friends. Again, thank you to everybody who's listened, subscribed, and downloaded, and also a special thank you to everybody who's given us 5-star rating. Again, it lets everybody know that you're enjoying what we're doing here. If you haven't subscribed and if you haven't rated us 5 stars, please do so. You can do that anywhere that you listen to podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, any platform that you listen to podcasts, you can find us. Just look for Far Betterment. In this episode, I'm joined by video creator and founder and CEO of Millennial Matrix Media, Amber Wyatt. Amber is an incredibly intelligent person, and she was a pleasure to speak to. And I want to thank her for being so open and honest and vulnerable with us here on Far Betterment. So without further ado, here's Amber Wyatt for Far Betterment. Hi, Amber. Andrew from Far Betterment.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, just wrapping things up at the office here.
Oh, nice. Well, I hope you had a good day.
Yeah, it's been busy, but always good. Always good to be here.
Absolutely, busy's good. Busy's great.
Yeah, for sure.
So, do you want to just jump into it?
Yep, let's just get right into it.
All right, sounds good. So why don't you tell me, you know, like a little bit about yourself, where you, you know, where you grew up and things like that.
It looks, wait, do you have a New York area code right here?
No, North Carolina.
It's Raleigh, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was Raleigh, but I was like, there's no way, like, maybe this has changed and it's like the New York area code now, but... Actually, where I grew up at in Virginia is, like, really close to Raleigh, and, like, we actually, like, leave my town in Virginia and go into North Carolina to, like, do stuff because my town is so small. Like, you have to go into, like, Winston-Salem or Greensboro or, like, even, like, Raleigh-Durham if you're feeling, like, real spontaneous just to, like, buy things.
Oh, that's
so
funny.
So, yeah, I'm from Kernsville.
Kernsville?
I don't know if you ever heard of it. Martinsville, Virginia.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought you said Kernsville.
NASCAR track.
I mean, it sounds familiar. And I've been to Virginia a few times. I like
no,
Virginia.
No one ever knows where it is.
Yeah, we're kind of in a small town too. We're in a town called Clayton, so nobody ever knows where this is either. But
okay.
But yeah, I always say Raleigh because it's really close.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm from Martinsville. I moved out here, officially to Manitou Springs in November of 2015. But, I had been out like several times prior to that for internships during my undergraduate studies at Holland University.
Okay.
And, I had been doing work out here and I was like dating a girl out here and like, it was all good. But, what ended up happening, I went back to Martinsville for about a year
mm-hmm.
and, then I moved back to Denver in the summer of 2017 and I had been back and forth, at that time as well, but I'm here in Denver now. So that's the long story short.
So do you miss like that hometown feel at all, or are you like over it completely?
It's like part of like the reason why I don't like take no for an answer, like, and I strive so hard out here in my business because like there's no going back.
Yeah.
Like literally last time I went back, I feel like I was in danger like for my life like multiple times. So like there's just like no going back to a place like that for me. Here, it's amazing. Like, it's growing. I wanted to be in the middle of, like, something that's happening. Like, You know what I mean? Like, we're making change here, and, like, there's a community for me here. Like, there are opportunities here. Anything that you want to get involved in, like, you can get involved in Denver. I mean, maybe it's, like, not the biggest industry here, like, what you're interested in, but there is an industry here in what you're interested in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love it here. And business is booming for me. So, like, I don't know. None of this would have been possible if I didn't live in Denver. So,
yeah. Why do you think that is? What is it about Virginia that, like, held you back?
Like I said, we got to drive an hour or two away just to buy something.
I hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, there's like no community there. There's no like understanding or like compassion for like what's really happening. It's a really sheltered place where people kind of just come to their own conclusions and they like get stuck in that mindset. Also, like, my town, Martinsville, was literally on the list for one of the highest unemployment rate or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, like, it was a huge textile industry there. And, like, when all the NAFTA stuff happened, like, we literally had, like, no jobs. It was, like, 70-something, like, percent, like, unemployment for a long time. And then it was also on the list for, like, one of the highest, like, opioid addiction, like, like towns, you know.
Oh, wow.
So it's
yeah.
just like it was hard for me to find people that I was really like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's people that I vibe with obviously, but it's just like, no, like this is not gonna be good. Like there's a lot of crime, there's just a lot of like just weird stuff that goes on and just like stuff that people talk about and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
No, that's not right.
I know you kind of touched on this a little bit, but what took you out to Denver to begin with? Like, why did you choose Denver out of all places?
I think it was in 2014. Let me think. Yeah, in 2014, I had an internship out here because my university, offered J-term, so you could use January to, like, do an internship and experience your industry, like, firsthand,
mm-hmm.
and that would, like, count for academic credit, and so I did my first, well, no, I did my second J-term internship. When I first started at Holland, I was a film major, so my first internship was at Parabolic. I was doing post-production sound, and I lived in Brooklyn on 36th Street, and I, like, commuted to Manhattan every day.
Okay.
So, my second one was at the Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center. And I had a friend out here and I could stay with her. And, basically it was amazing. So what I was doing there at the Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center was, publishing art historical reviews for the permanent collection, I forgot his title, but under Michael Howe. I forgot. I know at the Manitou Art Center, he's the director of exhibitions, but I know what he is. He's the registrar. So he does all the paperwork for incoming exhibitions there.
Okay.
So, he had me doing these papers and this research and stuff on like every piece of art that they have in their permanent collection. And then it was the following month that he wanted me to stay. So it actually turned into like a longer internship than like usually people were allowed to have. And then, so I really hit it off with everybody there. It was cool. And then the next year, like when J-term was approaching, I was like looking for internships. And then Michael was like, I want you to come out, this year and work at the Manitou branch. So a lot of this has changed now. And, Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center is actually property of Colorado College, and the Manitou Art Center is not a branch of it anymore. But at this time, Manitou Art Center and Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center were the same entity, and Michael was working at both. So he wanted me to have the Manitou experience, and I was, like, obsessed with Manitou Springs. Like, I was like, this is the cutest little, like, mountain town. It's beautiful. Like, I love this place. So I was working there and I was doing, installing some exhibitions this time. And I got to meet this really cool artist, Wanda Veldkamp. She's like this, like older, like really like spiritual, like artistic lady, and she does like landscapes from her childhood. Like a bunch of the places that like she painted, I actually went to because like they're that beautiful. And a bunch of them are in South Dakota. Like that's where she grew up, like near Sylvan Lake. And so I went up there and like drove around and like went to different places. And like they're literally like as beautiful as her paintings. Like they're just amazing. So I also was doing the promotion and like advertising for this event called Wunderkin. So it was Wunderkin 2015 exhibition, and they get like sort of it's high school kids, it's juniors and seniors that apply, and they get to do an exhibit. But it's typically like kids who like express themselves with art. Like, I mean, like society would say like they have behavioral issues, but they're like the coolest kids ever, you know. Like, and so they use this art as an outlet to express themselves. And I thought that was really cool. So I was really like, I was gung ho for like being a part of that and like advertising that. So I like went really in, and I ended up winning an award for like my promotion of the event. It had the largest turnout ever.
Oh, wow. That's impressive.
So, yeah. Like the Pikes Peak Art Council in May of 2015 awarded me with like, it was called the Arts Opportunities Award. Because like, yeah, I was just calling like school boards. Like I was getting kids to like do it. And then I was like telling them to promote it. Like it was just crazy. So, that was kind of like how I got started in marketing there. And then, yeah, so I always wanted to go to grad school out here as well, but I don't know. It was in, it's hard for me to remember all this, but.
Oh, no, you're fine.
Michael asked me to come back, and I was going to be working at the Manitou Art Center after I graduated college. And that was like the fall of 2015. So it was in November that I moved out, and I was actually living in Manitou. But it turns out that, like, the job I was supposed to get, like, they thought the woman was going to move to Texas to, like, take care of her dad. And she, like, didn't do that because his health turned around, which is great. But I didn't get the job that I, like, moved out here for. So I still, like, stuck it out for a while. But it was, like, a really hard time. So that's why I ended up going back to Virginia during that time. So I never actually worked with the Manitou Art Center before everything changed. But when I moved out the second time is when I really had like my big break out here.
And what was that big break? Was that working, starting your business or?
Okay. So it was in November of 2017 that I started an internship with the Art Institute of Colorado.
Okay.
And it's so funny because, like, they weren't advertising for an internship. Like, they weren't interested. Like, I just went there every day. And I was working at another call center out here. And it just really sucked. And I wanted to work in art. You know, I knew whatever I wanted to do, I wanted to do art-related stuff. So I was like, Art Institute, that's how I get my foot in the door. That's how I meet people out here that are also interested in the art world. So at first, they were like, yeah, there's this professor. Yeah, let me go back. So I kept going in and, like, talking to the security guard. Like, at first, I couldn't even get past the security guard. And I was, like, leaving my resumes with him. I was like, hey, I'm here to, like, inquire about an internship with the Art Institute. And he's like, oh, we have an internship with the, and I'm like, I don't know, but like, I'm coming in here, like, you know. So I just like kept doing that. And so finally, somebody called me and she was like, we have a professor here that wants to interview you for the internship. And his name's like Tom something. And he's super cool. He was a professor that like took his students, like, or he like offered his students a field trip annually to Japan because like in Japan, there's like this huge culture of 35 millimeter and like darkroom photography. And that was like this dude's specialty. And so like he would take them, like his students to Japan to like, you know, learn about that and like to see like just the culture from the Japanese perspective, because it's totally different than like us here. Like it's all iPhone out here. So Yeah, so I was like, this is going to be super cool. Like, I'm going to go to Japan, like, whatever. But then after I met him, like, shortly after, I got the word, you know, he wasn't trying to work with me.
Okay.
So I was bummed, but literally, like, a few days later, they were like, come in. There's another professor here who is interested in. So I go in, and I meet this guy, Kevin Campbell, and we just, like, immediately hit it off. Comes to find out he sold a couple films to Lionsgate and like he was this Hollywood director and all this. So, but it was like in the 80s and 90s. So it was like little, like, okay, he did Backsplash and Cheerleader Ninjas. So I'm just going to drop those, but it's like not
nice,
films
okay.
that anyone's ever heard. Yeah. You probably never heard of those, but like back then, you know, like they were those like scary movie, like what's the name of that funny scary movie like with the Wayans Bros?
Oh, geez, now it's gonna.
It's just Scary Movie. That's right. It's just Scary.
There we
movie.
Go. Yeah. Okay.
So, there were movies like that. They were like horror film spoofs.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? So, but I think the dude is really cool or whatever. So I start the internship with him, and there was like a lot of work for me to do there at the university with the students. But as well as that, there was a lot of the work from his company that was overflowing. And I was just like, you know, like I was doing a lot. And so I think at some point he was like, this isn't right. Like, I'm going to hire for my company because I was already doing stuff. So he hired me to work for his company, Kevin Campbell Films, and we were making good money. I was buying all this equipment. I was in the office every day, but technically I was still just an independent contractor. So, and also Kevin was like renting my equipment for shoots. And I was just like, dude, like, let's just both save money. Like I went into his office one day and I was like, make me a partner with the company, like pay me what I want, give me the hours I want, we'll share the equipment, and like I'll pay half the office rent, and like together I know we can do so much more. So like let's just do it that way. So so basically we started expanding like crazy. We had to hire 3 employees. We started renting a studio space and an office space. So basically all that's going on, it's crazy. But then at the same time, Kevin has a little side hustle that he does. So with the video marketing that we were doing, he was also creating and managing video learning management systems for franchise owners, which is like really big in the franchise world.
Okay.
Because like if you have a franchisee like for your company in Akron, Ohio, and they're like say it's a McDonald's because that's a franchise. Okay, they don't even like the M on the sign is like blue. Like that is a huge liability issue because of branding. So like they're not allowed to do that. And like with the learning management system, it kind of saves your ass. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're the franchisor and you're administering this learning management system, then you can always go back when a legal issue comes up and say, no, I talked to them about that. They were assessed on that and they completed the course and passed the course. So, you know what I mean? Like if the M is blue, like I don't know why they're doing that, but then the franchisor is not liable for it and they're not going to take the whole franchise down. They're just going to take one down. So he was doing that and he was wanting to kind of convert over to just doing that full time. So at some point he was like, you know, I'm going to start this business, Your Video LMS. But I still have all these marketing clients. I don't want to do marketing anymore. And the reason why was because like he his equipment for training videos is like pretty basic. You can use like news broadcast stuff, but like for Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Vimeo, like stuff like that, it was just like changing so rapidly. He was like, I don't even care. Like, you know what I mean? Cause he's an older guy. So he's like, you need to take my marketing clients. You need to start your own business. So, and I'm like, dang, that's cool. Like, I can just, like, you know, most of the time when people start businesses, they don't immediately have clients. So
yeah.
It was a great opportunity that I couldn't pass up. So I started Millennial Matrix Media doing video marketing and some blogging for a bunch of the franchise clients. And literally, he started Your Video LMS.
So we are two entities now, but we're like, you know, together. We're like partner, like business partners, because I tell him things about that and he tells me things about this. So, yeah, all of that, that's basically where I am today.
No, what kind of like...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, go ahead, sorry.
Oh, yeah, wait, so there's something else too. So so then one of my marketing clients was Shepherd Brands Consulting, and Shepherd Brands Consulting basically he gives advice. It's a group of people, but it's mainly this one guy, Rick Grossman, who wrote the Franchise Bible. He's like an expert in the franchise world, and he's had a lot of success with helping franchises grow. So what he does now, he just like gives advice to franchises. So he has like four brands right now that he like is over at all times. And so basically I was doing marketing for that company. And ironically, some of his clients were my clients, because in the building like that I'm in, where my office space is where I get a lot of my clients. So me and him like started talking one day, and we were like, you know, the best way to train, educate, and market these franchises is with a book. We need to write a book. We need to have these guys write a book. So now I have three books that I like edited and like low-key wrote. Like, I didn't write them, but I wrote some. I wrote like, you know, a couple pages that are on Amazon now for these marketing, for these franchise clients. And one of them is for Kevin too, because Kevin like wrote a book on like how to sell your story. And when he did that, he created like his own online course, so people can go through and like learn about marketing and like learn about training and everything that he does, and like how it's effective to any business and it's applicable to any business. And then like the other two are for a junk calling franchise and a high-end home restoration franchise. So yeah, it's pretty cool. And then out of that, I got like more clients. Right now I'm working on a mystery novel, my first fiction piece. It's just crazy because I basically created my own major in college, because it didn't exist yet, but like I made it work. Like, I'm still doing like all the things that I wanted to do, you know. I'm still working in film, and I'm still writing, and I'm doing some marketing, but really it's using film and writing to market others. So I don't know. I think that's pretty cool.
I think that's really cool. How did you, like, that takes a lot of confidence to be able to like just do things like that, you know? Like, most people wouldn't have like the wherewithal to just like make it work like that. Where did you get that from?
I think I probably got a lot of who I am from my parents. Mm-hmm. I'm really somebody who feels like no is like not acceptable. And I don't know, I work really hard for what I want, because like I mentioned previously, mm-hmm. there's no going back to where I'm from. Like, that's just not an option either. So, I don't know. I'm super loyal. I strive for quality. Like, I'm just a hard worker. Like, you know, if you know people from the country, I mean, that's how it is, man. You gotta work. And I don't know, my parents would always say like, do the right thing. And basically what that meant, the main components of that were like, to be honest and work hard. I think as I grew older, like this became like the definition of that is more complex, but it's really like those two things that like I go back to.
Yeah.
So I think people see that, and I don't know, some of the editors and stuff that I've hired, that they're like my age or young, like, they literally stay on their phone all day, and I'm like, dude, like, how can you even do that? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not, you just can't. I don't know. I just like work really hard. And plus my mom is just like amazing, like really outspoken. Like, she just asks for what she wants. So I just like, I want to like be somebody, you know, where I'm coming from. Like, I don't know, it's just different. So
I'm not going to, like, let opportunities, like, just pass me by. Like, that's not who I am, and that's, like, not the way I was brought up. I have to, you know what I mean? I have to speak up. I have to say, and then also if I'm, like, not feeling comfortable or I'm, like, not cool with something, like, I have to be, like, listen, like, let's do it this way. I don't know. That's just who I am.
No, I can appreciate that, though. Yeah, I can absolutely appreciate that. And what you said about the country and stuff, it, you know, I'm from there moving to here. So, you know, I had my experience in dealing with like some of the stereotypes or some of the things that I thought were stereotypes that actually weren't true and things like that. So, but the work ethic is absolutely true. You're right. I mean, 100%. Yeah. I think you put it like a perfectly. I've always really respected that a lot, actually.
I was just gonna add, like, it seems like in the South, like, it's, how can I explain this? It's, okay, like, how much you work or, like, your work ethic is so much, like, it's just, like, so definitive of who you are, like, I don't know. It's like there's a social thing too going on with it, because it's like if you don't work, like, and that's not cool. It's not cool because some people have mental illness, you know, and I do. I have mental illness, but people are so hard on you. It's like if you don't work, you're trash or something, like, and it's like that feeling that, like, I'm not saying that I was abused or anything. I'm just saying, like, that type of hardness, like, is good to a certain extent. And I don't think a lot of people are experiencing that anymore. And that could be problematic in different ways. But that's kind of how I feel about the South. It's like, it's almost embarrassing. Like, if you lose your job, it could be, like, literally, like, the worst thing that happens to you. Like, when that whole, I lived through that whole NAFTA thing. I saw so many people, you know, lose their jobs and they lost their identity. I could see something like that happening to me.
It's actually funny that you brought that up because, yeah, that's absolutely true. Like, when we moved here, I was actually like a stay-at-home dad for the first like year or something that we lived here because childcare is insanely expensive out here. Which was also a crazy surprise to me because we didn't, you know, just didn't expect it. And yeah, it was kind of like I was garbage. Like, nobody would talk to me other than like sometimes the wives would talk to me, which was really weird to me at that time. And like the men like just wanted nothing to do with me because I was a dad and that was like, it was really strange at first, but then I kind of got it. Yeah. Cause you're right. Your job is your identity out here. And like, if you don't have one, like you're a pariah.
Yeah, exactly. And like also in the South, like the roles are less
traditional.
I don't know. People might, yes, they're not as traditional. Exactly. And like people might not even believe that. But like my dad had a sister like that in the 60s and stuff, like moved furniture. Like, and she was like, everybody was talking about how strong she was and like how badass she was. And like there were a lot of female characters like that for me growing up where they just like didn't take any crap and like they could move a refrigerator. Like, so it was like, for me, like, it wasn't like, it's not like, you know, women do this and men do this. It's like everybody works, everybody holds their own, you know, and everybody's going to help the team out. So I think that probably sums it up for everything that I am today.
Yeah. I mean, just talking to you, I can tell like how, like, motivated you are and how ambitious you are. And like, I love what you said about no being just unacceptable.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Did you, so I kind of brought up like stereotypes moving out here. Did you have any stereotypes, or things that you thought like when you were moving out there?
Like only from South Park.
That's funny. Okay. That's hilarious.
I thought it was going to be like more pretentious, but it's really not. Like everybody's super cool and like down to earth and everybody's about like vibes and energy and stuff. So it's like, it's way more spiritual. Like, I don't think it's like, I don't know. I guess that's what I thought. I thought that, you know, it's not LA, but I felt like, you know, people won't like, people are going to be like, you know, what are you doing out here? Like, blah, blah, blah. But I don't know. It's not like that at all, honestly. I found like a really like solid group out here, and I don't even know where I would be without these people.
That's interesting you bring that up. Yeah, because I think that I get that a lot from people asking about Colorado, like asking about like how pretentious it is and things like that. And it really isn't.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you bring that up, because moving out here, I was told, you know, look out for things like racism and stuff like that. And you find that, but you find that everywhere, I guess, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess I was kind of expecting not the worst, but you know, different, I guess.
And like I think in my experience, mm-hmm. the bigger the population is in the area where you're going, like, is better, because
yeah.
There are more perspectives there, and there's more acceptance for those perspectives, and people have gotten used to those perspectives, you know,
and
simply put, where maybe in, you know, Raleigh, Durham, like they weren't even exposed to it before. So it's like,
I would say, I agree with you for sure. So I live in a town of like, it's not super small, but compared to like a Raleigh or, you know, Denver or whatever, like it is. I mean, there's like 19,000 people here, so it's not huge. But yeah, going from here to Raleigh, it's a whole different world, a whole different feeling. Like,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And then even from Raleigh to Denver, like in Denver, you can kind of like remain invisible if you really want to. And
yeah.
You don't see the same people.
Okay. I know, seriously. And like, this was one of the things that did it for me. Like, I came out to the Westwood Music Festival in 2014.
Okay.
And I saw, like, I was at Civic Center Park, and I saw this dude like smoking a joint like on the sidewalk, and mm-hmm. like a cop on a bike was approaching, and like where I'm from, like, oh my God, like something awful is about to happen. Like in Virginia, that's no, that's not happening. But then I see the cop, like the cop is on his bike, and he just like holds his fist out for like a fist bump, and he like fist bumps like the dude smoking the joint. And I was like, I'm moving out here. Like I have to, this is a different planet. This is crazy. Like, and literally, like, you can smoke, like, pretty much, like, I mean, I don't know if it's still like this, but you can pretty much smoke anywhere. Like, no one's going to say, I mean, what I'm saying is, like, I don't know if that's actually legal, but no one's going to say anything to you. And, like, some cops are even that cool. Like, the cops out here are trying to end homelessness. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they're actually doing things. So it's not about weed. Like, who cares about weed? That's one of the coolest things.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. We moved, like, right before that. The marijuana law like went into effect like right before it got legalized.
Dang.
Yeah. Well, I mean, mostly because of traffic. I'm honest, I just thought like, wow, it's going to get super busy here. I'm out. And then we just left.
No, and it did.
Yeah. It got crazy. Just going back to visit is like scary, insane. Just driving through like, I don't know, I-70 or I-25 is like, such a headache.
I know. I-25 is crazy. I try to tell people, and they're like, no, how bad can Denver be? I'm like, you don't even know.
It's so busy.
But, like, you have to remember, like, how beautiful that is, because people's mm-hmm. lives are being destroyed for that.
Well, that's true,
and even myself, I've even gotten possession of marijuana charges before. I'm only 27. It's like, what? Like, but that was all in Virginia and North Carolina, so it's like, that could have destroyed my life, you know, if the circumstances had been different. Like, but out here, it's just, like, so welcome. Like, I think that's amazing. Like, there's no reason why somebody should be locked up for that.
No, I don't think so either. I think the fact that so many people are locked up for that in other parts of the country is insane and ridiculous. I mean, it's marijuana. Like, it just doesn't seem like that big of a deal. And, you know, it's treated like cocaine or heroin, or, you know, in some cases, like, heroin even has like a sense of sympathy towards it, because it is like a life-changing disease to be addicted to heroin. And
Mm-hmm.
Marijuana is just not in the same class at all. It shouldn't be. It's,
I know.
It's crazy that it is.
It's crazy. Yeah.
So did you, when you moved out there, did you expect to be welcomed the way you were? Or, I mean, I know you said you thought it might be like pretentious and you were a little worried about that, but when you did get accepted, like, was that just mind blowing to you? Or
it was mind blowing that, like, just like when I saw that scenario in City Center Park in 2015, like,
yeah.
Just talking to you about how much Kevin helped me, like, and then Rick Grossman, like, there's just so many people, like, in my professional life and in my personal life that have helped me, you know, really helped me. And I feel like I had helped some people before, too, and it was just, like, not there. It was like, you know what I mean? There's, like, no appreciation or, like, there's just too much other stuff going on for some people, I think. I don't know, to be there for you when you needed them. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
It's just like people are out here helping me and they don't even know me. And then I'm thinking about, you know, stuff like that. Like, well, people that I like do know back home, like can't help me. Like, because I guess they're not able, like in the ways that people are out here, but I don't know. It was just surprising that like, I got so much help and like, he gave me his clients, you know, you have to think about that. Like, that's insane.
Yeah.
And like with, For Her Art for Charity, like they just wanted somebody to do video marketing, for the first event. It was a team. It was me and another guy, a really good videographer out here, Ivrin. That's Elit Creative. Y'all should check him out. But, they just wanted videographers to market the event. And then I was so like engrossed with it all and like female empowerment and just like being able to like be involved with something like that, that I've always wanted to be involved in, but I didn't even know where to get started, that they weren't just like, you know, well, it's us, like, and you're just doing marketing. Like, they were like, yeah, like, whatever, like, anything I said, like, I went to all the meetings, like, they were down to hear me out. They were down to hear my story. They were down to hear, like, why it was significant to me and, like, to let me, like, just come right in and, like, throw out ideas and, like, just collaborate. So with them and then, like, I've met a bunch of artists out here that I've worked with and made videos for, and it's just crazy. Like, everybody looks out for each other, and it's, like, always good vibes.
What do your parents think about your move?
My parents are just like, you're crazy. So they're, like, they're super proud of me, but they're just, like, they are, like, they stay there, you know? Like, they might go to Gatlinburg City or something. Like, they don't, you know what I mean? They stay in the same area, and, like, they've never flown on planes. They've never like taken a cruise or anything like that. Like, I don't know. And I just like, I've jumped out of a plane like literally 3 times. Like, they're just like, what? Like, I don't know.
Like, you're insane.
Like, they kind of think I'm crazy, but at the same time, like what my mom was telling me to do, like my whole life, like my mom just was like, do whatever, you know, like just go out there and experience life and just do whatever. Like, cause I don't know. They didn't like want to do stuff that they didn't do. I don't think. I just think like I really wanted it, and like I was talking about this stuff since I was young. Like, I used to be obsessed with maps, and I used to be obsessed with film. Like, I used to literally watch The Shining like before I went to bed.
Really?
Like, as a child, like I was obsessed with like the cinematography of Stanley Kubrick. Like, I was like at another level. Like, as a child, I was like analyzing film and like writing and like. It was crazy. Like, for my 5th grade graduation, like, I had written so many, like, short stories, like, in elementary school that an author of a book, I forgot the person's name, but it wasn't, like, a huge book or anything, but, like, a local author of a book, like, came to my 5th grade graduation and, like, gave me a special award, and it was, like, the book that they wrote and was, like, I expect great things from you, and it was, like, you know, like I was,
so cool.
And like I was always talking about like Hollywood and like I was like dancing like a Spice Girl. My mom was just like, okay, she's different. Like, go do your thing, girl.
That's very cool. So they've always been like really supportive.
Yeah, they're super supportive. And I think like I kind of changed their life too, because
my brothers like really buy the books, and like I really challenged some of their beliefs and some of the things that they thought and they struggled with, you know. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, like, what can you say? Like, it's your daughter. Like, and I think I opened their mind up to a lot of stuff, like being with girls, for example. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like I don't think they would have like even thought, like they would have never even thought about that if it wasn't for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that's true for a lot of people though? Or do you think like that's a traditional like Southern thing that they wouldn't have thought about that wouldn't occur to them?
I think that's a generational thing, honestly, yeah. because you have to think, I was born in 1992 and like my parents were born in 56 and 55. They're yeah. a lot older. But my brother is 19 years older than me. So like, oh, wow. you know what okay. I mean?
So that's a big difference. Yeah.
I think that's kind of why I was challenged to like do some of the things that I was doing as a child, because I was like around adults and yeah. like they were talking about Grace Kelly and they were talking about Conway Twitty and they were talking about all these old, you know, Peter Bogdanovich, and I was being exposed to old John Wayne Westerns and stuff like that, because I don't know. And so, you know, if somebody's mom was maybe like born in 1975 or something, they had a different childhood than I did. So I was kind of raised different because my parents are older, and you know, like that just wasn't their world. Like nobody was gay and like nobody asked me questions. So
what happened when you did tell them? What kind of questions were they asking then?
I remember like the first time actually, this is crazy. I came out when I was 9 to like my dad's best friend. Like when nine, okay. I was like, or actually like, I think it started when I was like 7, but like I would only wear like boy clothes mm-hmm. and like, I would only wear my hair back in a ponytail. And like, I don't know, like, I guess I had little girlfriends and stuff, but, like, I don't think they really acknowledged it. Then they were just like, I don't know what they thought, but they let me wear boy clothes. You know what I mean? So that's
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
And I was a tomboy. I was around all boys and I was like playing sports and doing stuff like that. And I guess they just thought that, you know, whatever, she's a tomboy. And so, but I remember one of the first times I talked to my dad, it was like these two girls. I was like in college. It's so stupid and probably like disrespectful to women. It's like, I don't know. I was ignorant. But I had, like, two girls, and I was, like, trying to figure out, like, which one did I really want to be with. And I was, like, talking to my dad about it. And he was just, like, go with the prettiest one.
Oh, that's awesome, though.
And it was just, like, dude, like, we're actually sitting here, like, bro talking right now. Like, this is amazing. Like, I never would have thought, like, you know, this dude would really be, like, sitting here. I mean, doing the best he could with advice. Like, he just jokes around a lot. So it's like, he's not really going to get too deep on it. Like, okay, what's this, this, and this? That's what my mom is for. But my dad is just like, you know, basically just talking crap. Like, okay, well, what's this one look like? What's this one look like? Show me a picture. And that was just like so cool because I never imagined that happening. And then, I mean, I don't know. They weren't like too extreme with like racial insensitivity, but there were some things, you know, mm-hmm. that I could tell they didn't really know weren't okay. And then like at my college graduation, my parents both saved like a seat at graduation for my girlfriend who was also black. So like that was another turning point where I was like, this is crazy. Like, you know, like it never got to the point where we like argued, like it was never like that. But I kind of felt anxious at some points. Like, are they going to say something? Like, is this going to like, are someone going to be mad? And it never got to that point. Like every time I asked them to do something, like they were just like, okay. Like they're kind of thinking like, this is weird, but okay. And then like, it was just normal, you know? So
yeah,
I don't know that both. I remember both of those points being like, really like cool. And then like, and now today it's just totally cool. Like I can say anything in front of them and they're like, okay, like yeah, whatever. Like they, like I can't shock them anymore. They're like, okay.
Yeah. That's cool.
It's kind of cool that I think we challenged each other because like, I know like the ways
you know, the work ethic and things like that that I explained earlier. But
yeah.
And now, like, they kind of accept things that I don't know if they ever would have accepted for other people outside the family. Because you have to remember, like, if it had been somebody else, I think it would have been different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, it was me saying it. They actually sat down and thought about it. Like, okay, you know, Amber wouldn't do something, you know, so, you know, I don't know what they thought, but you know what I mean? Like, I think if somebody else would have been gay or somebody else would have been biracial, like, honestly, like, my parents wouldn't have seen it the same way. But now, because of me, they're not, you know, they're not thinking like that about anybody anymore. So,
yeah.
Crazy.
No, I mean, it's amazing, really. Your parents are... They seem like really, really, really supportive and like they love you a lot, you know, like just from how, you know, obviously I don't know your parents, but it sounds like they really love you and like they're really willing to like accept everything, you know, because you're their daughter. And I think that's really all you can ask for as a child of any parents, really, you know. They just accept you and love you and support you.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm that kind of dad. You know?
Aww.
No, I mean, really, yeah. Though, that stuff makes you think as a parent. Like, well, I have three kids. So it really makes you think as a parent, like, God, I hope I'm doing that. You know, I hope I'm always open to my kids being who they are at all times, you know?
But. Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure you are, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you hope
I'm
so.
Sure
yeah,
are.
you really hope you are. I guess as a parent, like you don't really know how bad you fucked your kids up until they're older, and then you find out. So my kids are like 9, 3, and 2, so I got a while to figure that out, I guess. We'll
it's
see.
It's such a complicated, like, topic. Like, I don't even know what to say because, like, I have no experience there. And, like, I wouldn't want to say, like, the wrong thing to you. But,
oh,
like,
no, not at all. I mean, you're... Like,
oh, I don't know anything about being
totally
a parent
fine.
Yet.
Yeah, you're totally... Do you want kids someday?
I do.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, it's just so far in the future. Like, I need more time. I don't know if it will happen because I don't know when I'll be ready and I don't want to do it if I'm not ready.
No, that's really smart and mature. I mean, I think a lot of people do that way before they're ready and then it's sets off like panic and
Yeah. Seriously.
You don't want to do that. And yeah, that's a whole different world.
I'm like, my clients are my kids. Like, I always
joke. Oh, there you
that.
Go. It sounds like you have like a lot of, it sounds like you're juggling a lot of things, as far as your business goes. How, like at any given time, how many clients do you have like working on at a time?
I would say like 12 to 15,
oh,
like in
wow.
that range.
That's crazy. That's
yeah.
You're right. You're busy.
Yeah, but that's just who I am. Like,
yeah,
that's how I want it to be. Like, and I don't know. I think my life has like always been kind of chaotic. So, whenever I came here, like to this office for the first time with Kevin, like it was literally so chaotic. I was like. I don't even want to leave. I don't know. It was comfortable for me. I'm like on the fly. Like I don't even know how to do this, but I'm down to watch a YouTube video. Like, let's learn, like, let's do it. Like, so this is the perfect place for me. And like, this is exactly what I wanted, honestly.
So you kind of thrive on that chaos then.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. I like book my schedule up. I'm like, boom, boom, boom. Like, okay, what else can I do? I'm like looking for something else. So
what do you think that is? Do you think that's...
I think that's me finding, like, a healthy way to like, I don't know if it's express my anxiety or, like, control my anxiety, but I, like, was definitely like, I struggled with alcoholism, like, in my past, and that was, like, one of the reasons why I felt, like, several times in 2016 that, like, my life was at risk. And also, like, I've just seen, also Xanax, I have to be honest, but, like, yeah, I don't know. Let's see how many days. I'm like almost 1,000 days sober. Like, I'm going into 3 years now.
Good for you.
So I've seen, like, a lot of people die. Like, it's just like, I want to, like, work, you know what I mean? And, like, kind of keep myself busy, and it's not, like, unhealthy, you know? So it's like, I don't know. I think that's what it comes from, because I have, like, an addictive personality. And, like, I've struggled with stuff before. So, like, now in this chapter of my life, it's more. Also, I really like to help others, and I like to please others. So a lot of my addiction and a lot of, like, the unhealthy relationships that I had stem from me thinking I was helping somebody, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Thinking, you know, I was pleasing somebody, or also having things that, like, I just couldn't deal with, and I didn't have a community to, like, help me work through. So I was just like, you know, I can't go out tonight with these people feeling like this. I need to do something. Let's take a couple shots. Like, let's do a Xanax. Like, okay, now I feel better.
Yeah.
And just stuff like that. So now it's like working really kind of gives me the same high, I guess. That might sound weird, but, like,
no,
it's
not
like
at all.
A high that's. And I'm, like, not, like, I always say that, like, if I wasn't doing this, like, I would be trying to help somebody, like, that, you know, doesn't even probably want to be helped. Like, to the point where, you know what I mean? Like, I'm self-destructing, trying to, like, talk to somebody, like, da-da-da. And it's, like, really, those are for other people to decide, and, like, for other people to go and, you know, do and accomplish. And I was trying to do, like, way too much. And it was just sad. It's just sad, you know. Everybody knows that. It's sad to see people do things, like, hurt themselves or whatever. But yeah. You can't process, you know, the point where you're not helping yourself and you're hurting yourself. It's like, no. So, like, I'm helping clients. I'm, like, addicted to my work. But it's, like, profitable and, like, fulfilling. So it's, like, you know, it was a good replacement.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, well, congratulations, first of all. It's not easy. And actually, I speak from experience. I'm coming up on 3 years in November. So I totally feel
nice. Congrats.
There. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's not easy. at all. And you know that. And what do you think it was for you that made you think, like, okay, this is too much, it's gone too far, I need to stop? And then how did you stop?
I was, well, it's two things, and they're, like, really dark, so I'm just going to touch on it.
You don't have to be specific. I guess I'm not really asking necessarily, like, what specifically happened. You know, I don't want you to have to get into, like, that kind of stuff. I don't want you to be uncomfortable. I guess I'm more asking, like, where was the moment or the thought, I guess, that you were like, okay, I have to change something. And then, you know, like, how did you change that? Did you seek help, or were you one of those people that, like, you know, you're obviously a very motivated person. You know, I almost get the sense, like, that you can put your mind to something and then you'll just do it, you know? So I guess I'm kind of more interested in that.
It's just things got really bad, and I found myself in a really confused place. Mm-hmm. Long story short. And I had a night where, like, literally I don't know what happened to me. Mm-hmm. So, and I, like, still don't know. So, after that, it was just like, I'm going to die, or, like, you know, maybe something even worse is going to happen that I'm going to have to live with. So I can't do this anymore. Like, I can't be around these people. Like, I can't, You know what I mean? And yeah. So, it was just easy at that point. Like after that happened, like it was just like, damn, like, no, like, just no, like I've literally been putting myself at risk because I mean, you're in high school and like, it's fun. And like, there's nothing but house parties in the country to go to. And like, everybody loves you. You know what I mean? It's just like, yeah. Whatever. It's like high school stuff and you're just partying. Like it's party culture. Okay. Like that's cool and everything. And like that, everybody knows like that dies eventually. And I was there, like, I knew like, okay, this isn't going to last forever. But like, whenever it gets to the point where like people are like stealing off of you, people are abusing you. And then like at the end of it all, like you can't even find anybody who wants to listen. You know, it's like yeah. Everything in my life has to change. Like, I don't even know how I got here. So I don't know. I mean, I was always like working and stuff like that. Like it never got to the point where I was like, you know, like, I don't know. It never got to, it could have been worse. It could have been worse, but, I don't know. I just felt like it was easy. Once I like had that realization that like, this is not normal, like behavior. And it's really normalized in the region and in the community that I'm in right now.
So you had the foresight to see that like your circle, the people you surrounded yourself with were going to continue to cause, because I mean, obviously we do this stuff too, you know,
yeah.
to ourselves as addicts. But that circle was like a mitigating factor. Like they kind of persisted it.
It's not even that it was a mitigating factor. It's that like, I realized something that I couldn't explain I couldn't make these people understand.
Yeah. Okay.
And I actually experienced something, you know what I mean? That I couldn't even make them understand, that they weren't even seeing it the same way I was seeing it. So yeah. It was like, something's wrong. That made me think like something's wrong here. Like, yeah. I don't know what it is, but something's wrong. And it's like, it's not, you know, it's cultural, like it's society. Like it's not anybody's fault. And it's not that anybody like, was making me do something that I didn't want to do or anything like that. It was just that when I realized like, this is our everyday life. And like, I tried to like vocalize that, people were like, yeah, it's our everyday life. And I was like, well, no, maybe not for me. Like, yeah. No, I don't think, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's just crazy. And then, I wanted to say another thing about addiction, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so one of the things that I haven't really touched on yet and that, like, I feel really passionate about and I'm not really sure how to, I don't know, like, maybe I'll start a movement. We'll see. But I want to start talking about this more in public spaces because I don't know that a lot of people are. And if people are, then I want to definitely, like, learn more about that. But I was a foster child, and so the parents that I have now actually adopted me.
Okay.
And that was like, they got me as a foster child when I was like 4 years old. And then like, I don't think the adoption was finalized until like I was 8. But as a foster child in the 90s specifically, I don't know if it's still like this, but like literally so, I was prescribed so much medication. And like, whenever I like told my parents, like, I don't want to do this anymore, they were like, okay, like, no problem. Like, but my parents weren't educated, you know, in psychiatry and in, you know, the medical field to understand, like, you know what I mean? To maybe say before it got to that point, she doesn't need this. You know, they're therapeutic foster parents. They have a heart of gold. They want to help people and they want to understand people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's where they're coming from. But then there are counselors and psychiatrists and doctors that these foster kids are like, you know, like not forced, but like scheduled to go to. And like my parents had to abide by those rules and stuff. So I was in a situation basically at age 16 where like I had anxiety that I didn't even know about, and I couldn't deal with it, and I had some other things going on, and I couldn't deal with it, and I started drinking because I had been medicated my whole life up until that point, up until the point where I said, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, I was like, think about this. Literally, I was prescribed medication when I was 5 years old. Like, wow. That doesn't even make sense. And like, I don't know why that's out here happening. Like, a 5 year old is just a 5 year old. And in the 90s, the reason why I said the 90s specifically is because I was on Ritalin, I was on Vyvanse, I was on Adderall, I was on Strattera, I was on Abilify, I was on all of those ADHD medications.
Yeah.
And for what? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think I'm ADHD at all. Like, I've never felt like I'm ADHD or ADD, like, in my adult life. But, like, I feel like there were other things that ADHD was kind of just, like, the Band-Aid, and it was kind of just, like, it made other things, like, dismissive. So, I don't know. I just don't think that, like, kids should be put on prescription medications or, like, tested on prescription medication, because, like, I don't know, but, like, that could be some of it. I don't know, like, there should be an age limit on this stuff, like 12 or something. Like my brain's not done developing, so you know what I mean? How is somebody supposed to go out here and really live life and deal with life if they've been medicated forever?
I think that's an incredible point. Yeah, my brothers were like medicated like that with, you know, Ritalin and Adderall and stuff too when they were really young. And I always kind of thought like, oh my God, what are we doing? Why are they on so many pills? They're just kids, you know?
Yeah. And I even had like a really good friend, that came out to her mother. And when she came out to her mother, she put her on Xanax and she was like, you're not gay, you're just depressed. And she ended up getting addicted. Yeah. And it's like, how did that even happen? Like, this doctor that, like, the mom took her to, like, should have known better and should have said, like, she's not depressed. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just, I don't understand why that's happening. And I think that is what led into my addictions as, like, a teenager and in my early adulthood, because it was just too much, like, literally, like, from age 5 to 16, like, that's crazy.
Well, it's a lot of for your brain to cope with coming off of those medications, too. I mean, obviously, it takes a lot of getting used to even get on those pills, and I tend to agree with you, because I wasn't medicated, like, heavily as a child, but when I turned like 11, 12 is when I first started being prescribed like antidepressants and stuff. And I never felt like I should have been, I don't know. Have you ever taken antidepressants?
I'm not even sure. I think yeah. Zoloft and usually mood stabilizers.
I've been on both of those, and then I've been on, like, I couldn't even name all of them, Celexa and all kinds of stuff. And I think it's hard as a kid, like, when you're medicated like that, because you don't even really understand what you're feeling at that age, let alone, like, how to express what you're feeling other than, like, a lot of times anger. I mean, anger is a really easy feeling to feel for anybody. So it's a hard subject to talk about, I think, because it's so touchy, you know, like, obviously there are some instances where medication's needed, but I think there's a lot of instances where medication's used as a fail-safe or as kind of a excuse for why your kid is acting the way they are.
Mm-hmm. And in sobriety, I found, like, so many alternatives that I'm just like, why was this never tried? Like, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
I understand, like, especially at that time, like, the pharmaceutical companies were cashing in. But it seems to me more economical to provide therapy or, like, acupuncture or meditation or yoga or something than these pills, you know, that cost so much to make.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, I'm literally like about to go to Capitol Hill. Like, I'm trying to fix this. I'm trying to make it like a cap on prescribing kids drugs. Like, only certain exceptions. Like, I got to do more research, but I'm just joking. But like, I really do feel passionately about this. So I don't know what we're going to do.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up. Cause you know, nobody has yet, and it's not like it's a secret, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So I'm actually really glad you brought that up. Wow. That's 5 years old is really, really young to be prescribed that many medications. I mean, that blows my mind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
Do you, like, have you talked to your parents about that? Or was that this before? You said you were adopted by them at 8, right? But were you already living with them, or?
Yeah, I was already living with them since I was 4, but okay. I was in 3 foster homes prior to that.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I talked to my parents about the drugs. Like, they just, like, you know, I don't want to, like, I don't want to upset them. Like, they didn't know anything.
Oh, no, not at all. No, and I don't think that. I mean, I think a lot of it is the doctors, you know? Like, you trust your doctor. Like, you go to your doctor because they've gone to school and they're professionals and they have experience, and you trust them to tell you what to do or to give you the right treatment. And I don't think it's your parents' fault at all. That's definitely not
Like, they still keep foster kids, and I've like talked to them about like being more careful about like they're asking more questions, you know, and like my mom like watches YouTube now, and she's like learning from YouTube like a little bit about, you know, the psychology and stuff like that, and she'll like Google symptoms and like kind of behaviors and stuff that people do and try to figure it out, like what's the thing that I can do to like best communicate and stuff like that. But I'm just like, dude, like, if it's kids, like, just try to, like, not have them on the drugs. Like, and I guess they pay for that now. But I've had this theory, like, this is, like, far out there, but, like, I've had this theory that, like, foster kids, like, are, like, almost like minorities. Like, they don't have, like, the same rights that, like, a kid that like belongs to a, cause they're like the state owns them. You know what I mean? Until they have a family that adopts them, they're considered warden of the state or ward of the state or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's like, I feel like possibly like pharmaceutical companies like use them to test drugs to see what would happen, because there was this drug that like they tried on me whenever I was younger. It was called Abilify. And like, I took it for 2 days. And on the second day, like, I went outside to play with my friends. And like, literally, like, this just started happening. Like, I would take a step forward and like my spine would jerk back. And then I would like take another step forward and my spine would jerk back until like I collapsed on the ground. And like, if I try to get up, like I could get back up, but if I took another step, like my spine would jerk back again. And my mom was like so scared. She rushed me to the hospital, and they were like, it looks like she had an allergic reaction to the Abilify. We're going to take her off of it. Okay. They were running commercials. They were running ads, all this stuff. Boom. All of a sudden you don't hear about Abilify anymore. And then a couple years later, like 2 or 3 years later, it came back on the market and they reintroduced it as the new and improved Abilify. So I'm just like, was quite possibly like it was tested on me as a foster child. And you know what I mean? Maybe that's a stretch, but like, I really think like something like that could happen in this country. And yeah, that's self-evident. So,
well, it is interesting the way foster kids are treated. And
like, who speaks for them?
Yeah.
I mean, the government for them. Yeah. And obviously the government was profiting from the pharmaceutical company. So it's like, what's more important at the end of the day? That's like black and white in this country. Like, we obviously understand what that is, but, it shouldn't be, it should be the kid's life. Obviously. I mean, we shouldn't even have to say that, but I don't know.
But it is interesting because, I don't know. I think kids in general are kind of treated as you know, seen and not heard. And when it comes to foster kids, there it's even worse because now they're not, you know, a problem, obviously. They didn't create the situation that put them there. But they're treated like it's really hard to put into words because it's such a delicate subject and I don't want it to come out wrong, but they are treated, right, like you said, they are treated like kind of not as, like they're not, they don't hold the same value as a child with two parents would have even. And I'm a parent, or I'm a child of a single parent, and I think I was even treated differently than, you know, kids with two parents. And I went to school with some foster kids, and I know they were definitely treated even more differently than myself or a kid with two parents. It's really unfortunate, but they are treated kind of like they're almost throwaways. Like they, like this kid's already had it tough, so we're gonna try to work on this kid who has hope. And that's the sad part to me. Was just even being 12 years old and watching this, you know, like that's really horrible. And I don't think people really understand the way the foster care system works sometimes. I mean, because sometimes those kids are put into like these horrible homes and, and that's even, that's even more sad. I mean, it's just awful.
But I think more importantly than like the treatment is the legalities that surround their status. So like really what I'm trying to talk about is like, who is the representative for this child? Who speaks for this child? I understand you have a caseworker, you have a social worker, you have the foster parents, but in a legal scenario, none of those people can speak for the child.
Yeah.
I mean, they can speak for the child for a certain extent, but if you're going to, when I talk to my parents about it, they're like, we didn't like think we could even say no to the prescriptions. You know what I mean? Like we thought that, you know, that's what we had to do and we didn't know, you know what I mean? So it's like foster parents aren't really coming from a place where they know what to say or they're allowed to say it. Yeah. So it's like, even if they do know what to say. So I think that that's what needs to be reformed. Mainly because it's just like the foster parents should at least be able to speak for the child, like a normal, like, you know what I mean? Person that's not profiting off of anything, you know, really. I don't know. I that's what needs to be reformed. And that's what needs to be talked about now.
In that situation, I guess specifically with your parents, they were scared that they couldn't say no. Would they have, like, say your parents did say no, hypothetically, and the, you know, CPS or whatever decided that, no, they shouldn't have done that. They shouldn't have said no. They're not, you know, treating you properly, or they're not, you know, making sure that you're getting the proper treatment as recommended by a physician. Would they have rehomed you? Would they have taken you away from them or moved you to another foster home?
Stuff like that happens,
yeah.
Because my actually, okay, so I have a biological sister that was adopted by another family. The foster family that I was with before I came to the family that adopted me had me and my sister. So the lady that ended up adopting my sister sent me off to another foster family. She didn't want me. So when I got to my mom's house, we had visitations and everything. But my mom was like, this isn't right. Like, my mom's whole belief with the foster care system is that siblings should never be separated. She always says that. That's what she fights for in her job. So she actually took the foster parent that adopted my sister to court for custody of my sister before my sister was adopted because she thought that we should be together. Mm-hmm. And the woman was actually like fighting for, you know, my sister. And my mom was just like, this isn't right. Like, I just don't believe in this. And so what ended up happening was that
people basically like shamed my mom and acted like my mom acted out of pocket or something. But it was just something that she felt really strongly about, and she wanted to try to fight for it. And she didn't get custody of my sister, and we grew up separately. And the mom, like, took all rights away, like, for visitation and, like, all of this. But, like, why, like how is that legal?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So yeah, it's really,
like, just crazy, the stuff that happens. I honestly wouldn't put it past the people in charge to have taken me and put me in another place, because my mom tried to speak out one time and they were acting like, you know, this was a crazy thing to do, and like, you just don't challenge us.
Yeah. That's that puts them in a really, really difficult position too. Your parents, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. That is that's something nobody really sees or thinks about.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because, like, I don't even talk about it. I feel like if I have the platform, like, it's something that I should bring up.
Yeah, and I really want that to to resonate and stay fresh in people's minds. Thank you so much for being on. I appreciate it so, so much.
Thank you. This is amazing.
Oh, thank you for that. I appreciate that. That means a lot. And that concludes another episode of Far Betterment. Thank you to all my listeners. Thank you to all my subscribers. And thank you to everybody who's rated the podcast so far. If you haven't subscribed, you can find us on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, Apple, anywhere that you listen to podcasts, including where you're listening to podcasts right now. And please, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us tremendously. I can't tell you how much it helps us. If you want to give us anything less than 5 stars, please don't. There's really no reason.